Sì, oddio, sì, sì.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures. It's Tuesday, June 11th. We have one thing on our agenda, a public hearing on House Bill 2164. There are two main components of the bill and the amendments that we have. They're in two basic groups. One group relates to tax credits, and the other group relates to the technical adjustments we are making to the CAT, the 3427 tax that was recently passed. And in noticing that there are legislators in the room, we will start with what I believe you are here to testify on. Not signed up on a sheet, but I believe you're here for tax credits side, not technical adjustments. Mr. Alanak, will you give us a little bit of background on what we're seeing on the tax credits part of the amendments?
Sure. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And just if I could point out a couple of key documents for all relevant interested parties. There are a number of amendments on all this. In the meeting materials for today's meeting, there are three summary documents. One is titled Amendments to House Bill 2164. That is simply a table that shows each dash amendment and briefly what topic it touches on, so to try and keep track of all the amendments. And then there is a House Bill 2164-14 by section. That is kind of a statute to English translation of the dash 14, which is the CAT fixes. And then the third item in under meeting materials is something called HB 2164 Tax Expenditures Table. And that is the tax credits summary sheet. So if we're starting with that, and that's up on the screen right now, and it shows the three amendments related to tax credits, with the dash 11 being the main amendment. And then we still have the dash 3 and the dash 4. But catching people up to speed, the dash 11 replaces the dash 2 from last week. And there are three changes from last week. This one, the dash 11, includes the short line railroad rehabilitation tax credit. It includes the extension of the crop donation credit. And it includes the property tax piece, the historic property special assessment tax break. Those three pieces are now in the dash 11. They were not in the dash 2s last week.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm going to have to excuse myself from this committee to head to Ways and Means. My staff is watching, and I will be listening to a recording of this. And so while I won't be here in person, I will capture the information. Thank you for your understanding. And for the public, I'd share with you, we're moving out some final budgets, and so the end is coming very, very quickly. So thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Representative Finley.
Question for Mr. Alanak, Madam Chair. In the dash 11, section 38 was titled of historic housing. Is that in section 2 or in the old dash 2? Because I missed it in one.
No, that was not in the dash 2. Okay. So that's one of there are three new policies. So we have the dash 11 is the dash 2 plus three policies. And that is one of those three new policies.
So railroads, historic buildings, and farm credit or farm donation. Okay.
Crop donation.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any other clarifications or questions for Mr. Alanak before we begin the public testimony?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I can keep going if you'd like.
No.
Okay.
Representative Fahey.
Good
afternoon, Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Julie Fahey. I'm the state representative for House District 14, which is West Eugene and Junction City. And I won't take up too much of your time, but I'm here to testify in support of the educational savings credit component of the Dash 11, the basically replacing the 529 subtraction with a 521 refundable tax credit. And I'm here in my role as the co-chair of Oregon's Future Caucus, which is a bipartisan bicameral group of 12 legislators aged 42 and under that are focused on issues relevant to young people and to the future of our state. You can hopefully imagine Senator Hurd, who is my fellow co-chair, sitting next to me, but he is testifying one hearing room over. He wanted to be here to express his support as well, but I'll have to speak on his behalf. Polling data indicates that the majority of young people, regardless of political party, view access to higher education as a major issue facing young people in Oregon. As the cost of higher education continues to rise, lower-income families are disproportionately priced out of accessing one of the most important resources to give them a hand up in life. The use of 529 college savings plan as a tool for helping to manage the cost of college have become more and more common, but unfortunately, they are not equally used across all income levels. Historical data shows that simply by having an account opened makes a student three times more likely to enroll in a job training or college program and four times more likely to complete it. But unfortunately, the current tax subtraction for contributions to these plans doesn't benefit all families equally. Only 12% of current account owners are low or moderate income, and also account owners are much more likely to be in urban areas. Treasurer Reed's proposal to change the current state deduction to a refundable tax credit will create a meaningful reason for low and moderate income families to opt into a college savings plan. The revised proposal makes changes to the original proposal that will make it revenue neutral while also thoughtfully incentivizing the participation of families who can most benefit from making contributions. This is why Oregon's Future Caucus urges you to support that component of the Dash 11 amendment and vote it to the floor for consideration. As a side note, I'd also, taking my Future Caucus hat off, also like to express support for the Dash 4 and the political tax credit, especially as this body contemplates campaign finance reform. I think the political contribution tax credit is a really important way to incentivize grassroots political donations to candidates and political organizations. So thanks very much. Happy to answer questions and apologize for Senator Hurd not being able to make it.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. We have 11 people signed up to testify. I'm hoping that you'll be able to limit your testimony to 3 minutes each. And I'm not seeing signs of outrage. Let's try for 3 minutes each, please. Sarah Adams, Craig Smith, Janet Berg. After that, we'll hear from Karen Sachs, Shannon Vilhauer, thank you, and James Barta. Please begin, whoever's ready.
Did you want to do something different?
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for having us this afternoon. My name is Craig Smith. I am the Director of Government Affairs for Food Northwest. I'm here to speak to you about the food processing tax exemption that is now in the Dash 3 amendments. I think you're going to get another version of that soon. The Dash 3 amendments would continue to incentivize new investment in food processing equipment. This is for new equipment that is installed and only for the process equipment portion of that purchase. It's a limited and yet really important incentive for our industry to continue to make investments. It covers any products from fresh fruits, vegetables, nuts, grains, eggs, and seafood that are made into a finished product. Companies making these investments in Oregon receive up to a 5-year deferral on the property tax on that equipment, then it comes back onto the tax rolls. These investments allow us to get those machines up and running. These are huge machines, and it takes a while for the return on investment on those to come into being. And so it's really an important part of the investment strategy for food companies in the state. Oregon agriculture depends upon food processors as the value-added component of their production, and this is a real big winner for everybody in the state. Currently, the incentive that we operate under sunsets in July of 2020, and we're asking for an amendment that would move that sunset out to 2025, but also making important changes in how local governments interact with this program. So in an effort to provide some flexibility in the program and give local governments more control over this process, both counties and cities under the amendment that you'll see will have an opt-out provision under that amendment, and they'll also have the ability to toggle the amount of that tax credit. So it won't be an all or nothing option for each of those counties and cities. And we as food companies and Food Northwest support those changes and have worked with a bipartisan group of legislators to put that into place. At the request of the League of Oregon Cities and the Oregon Association of Counties. The counties are very supportive. The cities are probably still in a place, I'm guessing, I'm not speaking for them, that they would like to see further changes. However, what they've asked for would be a restructuring of the program to the point where we don't believe it would be workable. And so we really wouldn't like to go to that place. So we feel like we've come to a place that gives everybody the local control they need. We sincerely and most assuredly ask for your support and love the fact that this has been in place for a long time and would love to see it continue. So thank you very much.
Chair Nathanson, Chair Hess, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Janet Bird. I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I want to talk about our wish that you incorporate the Oregon IDA initiative into House Bill 2164. The Oregon IDA initiative brings hope to Oregonians with low incomes. It is a match savings program that rewards focused work on a financial goal with a boost to what individual effort can produce. IDAs are available throughout Oregon via a network of more than 80 partner organizations who directly offer IDAs, and a much broader set of Oregonians, of organizations that refer clients to IDA providers. We know that many Oregonians, at least 4 in 10, struggle with financial stability. Individual development accounts work on the ground in all of your communities in concert with other available tools and resources to give people that next step towards stability. They are a flexible, adaptable tool that supports a lot of local approaches and local work. We are asking for action from you in the 2019 legislative session to keep IDAs viable. We're asking that you incorporate the provisions of Senate Bill 790 into the tax credit omnibus. First, and absolutely essential, we need to change the value of the tax credit to donors because of the impacts on marketing of the changes in IRS rules made after the federal tax cut bill was enacted. And I know you've heard discussion of that in committee. We are asking for a straightforward adjustment to solve this problem. We now offer the credit at 70 cents of state tax credit per dollar received. We're asking for the ability to adjust up to $1 for $1. We have a history of marketing as aggressively as possible. We actually currently often market at 67 cents on the dollar. So I think you can be assured that we will extract every penny of value that we can in exchange for state dollars. But we feel like this change is essential to keep the initiative viable. With a cap of $7.5 million, which is currently in statute, that could be done at no cost to the state, no additional revenue impact. And we would be able to raise $7.5 million a year and hopefully more than that. We have previously, with the different federal tax treatment, last year we raised $10.8 million. So we would raise somewhere between $7.5 and $10.8. Without this change, which again could be done with no revenue impact, the viability of the entire initiative is threatened. As noted in the evaluation that I referenced later and parts of which are attached to my testimony, the average period of time someone saves in the initiative is 29 months. Middle school students may be enrolled for 5 years or more. A drastic interruption of funding, such as might be caused by an interruption in the viability of the marketing, would mean a loss of program impact for several years. And if it destabilizes any of our partners' ability to provide services, the wraparound services that go along with the match savings and the IDA, it could threaten the success of approximately 3,000 people currently saving through IDAs in your communities. Second, we are requesting an increase in the tax credit authority above $7.5 million. We are not scheduled for review until 2021, but we were flat funded last time we came in for a review in 2015. We've been flat funded since 2012. We know that Oregonians across the state are waiting for a chance to build better futures, and so we're asking for you to consider that increase. And finally, Senate Bill 790 included a few administrative statutory changes that would make the program easier to operate. In respect to your time limit, Chair Nathanson, I will refrain from reading the last few paragraphs of my testimony. You have it online, and it refers you to the executive summary of our annual evaluation, which talks about some of the impacts that we have on rural communities, communities of color, and other communities in the state. Thank you very much for your time.
Co-chairs Nathanson Hass and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Adams. I'm executive director at Cash Oregon, where we work together with AARP Tax Aid to expand access to the earned income tax credit through a network of volunteer-based free tax return preparation. This year, this network of services has provided a little over 46,000 free tax returns, and this in turn generated $47 million of federal tax refund dollars being brought into our communities throughout Oregon. And I'm here to talk to you about the earned income tax credit portion of this bill and the importance of the EITC and why we really do need to renew it and hopefully also raise it. And I've been coming down here for, we've had a few hearings on the EITC, and I've spoken with a few of you here already. And in thinking about what I wanted to express here today, I was reflecting back on a lot of the client stories that we hear every year through our services. And very quickly, a theme emerged. And that theme is that the benefits primarily inure to children. And this is because the vast majority of EITC claims go to adults with children in the home. In their client stories, you can see that the options that the EITC is providing to families, in particular, you know, a single mother of three able to buy beds for her three children, another parent who's able to enroll her son in swim lessons, and a father able to get his daughter access to medical treatment that hadn't been an option to that family before. And additionally, we continue to see further stories which demonstrate the importance of the earned income tax credit in addressing the gap in family budgets, and we continually hear that people are being afforded to pay their rent and build savings. We already know that early investment in children has a bigger payoff down the road. What we pay in today will come back in the future through higher graduation rates, higher test scores, increased college enrollment, and increased earnings as adults. This is reflected in research data that's already been submitted in written testimony in the record. I want to put one last plug in as well and really encourage you to end the exclusion for families with individual taxpayer identification numbers so that all of Oregon's children can benefit from these same benefits. So please invest in our children today with the enrichment and the social inclusion and the stability that comes with the earned income tax credit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Janet. I want to just ask you, did you offer your tax credits last year before or after the IRS ruling?
Chair Nathanson, Chair Hass, members of the committee, we typically offer tax credits throughout the calendar year. So last year we opened, I believe, on January 9th, and we sold out by mid-February 2018.
That was before the ruling, right? we've had that hit a couple of places, and we're struggling with how to respond to that. So that's one thing. The other thing, there are lots of IDA initiative supporters. I count myself as one of them. But you're not up for 2 years. EITC is up now. The processing equipment is up now. And I think that in this sort of relatively new 6-year cycle of tax credits, there is, or maybe there should be, a rule, or there's an unwritten rule that if you jump in line in front of others, that might screw up the whole system. And so we've tried to be very careful of dealing with just the tax expenditures that are on the verge of sunsetting. And so that's one of the reasons that I'd prefer to just wait on this until the next cycle.
I'm going to ask you a question. Could you please explain whether and how the policy changes are separable from the request to expand the credit?
Chair Nathanson, Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for the question. So I think it would be fairly straightforward to make the adjustment in the value of the credit without adjusting the value, the cap on the tax credit. You have actually two vehicles in your committees that you could do that with if you chose to do it outside of the omnibus bill. Senate Bill 790 is in joint tax expenditures. House Bill 3133 is in House revenue. While we love talking to all of you about this complicated bill, we would certainly be happy to move in a separate vehicle if that was the way to make the adjustment to the tax credit. I understand the issues of being in order and out of order. Again, we've been flat funded since 2012, so through the last renewal cycle. And I would argue that the change in the tax credit is really a matter of viability of the initiative. And if that needs to be treated separately as a no-cost thing, that's not something that makes us happy, but it would preserve the viability of the initiative.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yeah.
Next, and I realize there was some attempt to combine some people elsewhere on the agenda that had signed up later, but I'm just taking you in the order that you signed up in. Karen, Shannon, and James. After that will be Jessica, John, Calhoun, Bob Estabrook.
Chair Nathanson, Chair Haas, and members of the committee. My name is Karen Sachs, and I work at NEDCO and Willamette Neighborhood Housing Services. For over a decade, we have been members of the network of agencies that provide individual development accounts, education, and counseling. IDAs are one of the greatest financial resources we see in helping families attain and maintain financial stability. They are a key piece of the puzzle in providing services as they create opportunities for clients to take control of their financial future. IDAs have the distinct benefit of intersecting many of our lines of business and are a tool that build assets at all different stages in the life of a low-income Oregonian. Our clients are better prepared to weather the financial road ahead because of their participation in the IDA program. Demand for IDAs greatly outpaces available resources, and at NEDCO, clients face up to a 2-year wait to enroll. A disruption in funding for the IDA program would severely impact current and future savers, throwing them off of their path in building assets. The savings habits and knowledge gained through the IDA program are unlike any other program we have to offer our communities. For the folks who start a small business to increase their income, to the high school kids who start saving for their college, to the family that gets the keys to their very first home, IDAs change lives. Your support will continue to make this the reality for our neighbors, creating more resilient families and communities. We thank you for all of your work to support low-income Oregonians and urge your action this session to include the Oregon IDA Initiative in HB 2164. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Nathanson, and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Vilhauer. I'm the Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity of Oregon. During the past 2 years, Oregon Habitat for Humanity affiliates have provided over 150 first-time homebuyer opportunities, two-thirds of those located in rural parts of the state. Nearly every one of the homebuyers we serve brings an IDA down payment assistance account with them to closing. I think there are a couple reasons for that. The first and foremost is the excellent financial education that savers receive. Successful home ownership and the ability to budget effectively truly go hand in hand. The average income of the homebuyers we serve is 41%, or about $26,000 a year. These are households who are working as parking attendants, as housekeepers at local motels, working in restaurant kitchens, or maybe even firefighters. Without programs like Habitat for Humanity and the Oregon IDA Initiative, these folks don't have a chance to own such a key asset, their home, right? And what are the impacts? What are the impacts on these families? We are thrilled, thank you, Children First for Oregon helped us discern that 92% of the kids who grow up in Habitat homes graduate from high school. 16% higher than graduation for Oregonians of all income levels. 63% of the children we serve have better grades in school. 99% of the children who grow up in Habitat homes report improved health outcomes. Affordable homeownership developers like to say that we're bringing about an end to intergenerational poverty. Here's what we mean, right? Programs that empower Oregonians of modest means to save, to learn how to budget, to become financially savvy with the systems at hand, really empower families to permanently leave behind situations of struggle so that their kids and future generations can be more successful. Another thing I'm very pleased to report to you is that many Habitat homeowners, after they've moved in, have further accessed down payment assistance for advanced degrees. Think about that. So you have the asset of your home, you've increased your earning potential. I think that this is a very cost-effective investment in strengthening families, communities, and schools. Please strongly consider whatever you can do this session to renew and support the Oregon IDA Initiative.
Thank you.
Well, Chair Nathanson, Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is James Barta. I am the Strategic Director for Children First for Oregon, and I am here in my capacity also as part of the Raise and Renew Coalition. Now, IDA is on our children's agenda, as is expanding EITC, and I will add I am the second of a three-person panel that's been spread over three panels. But in any case, the Raise and Renew Coalition includes more than 50 community organizations, businesses and labor, advocacy and service, faith, all sorts of different organizations that at the beginning of session came together to support a rather ambitious bill that, you know, as session does to proposals, got more and more narrowed down as the session went on. We appreciate, though, that there was bipartisan support. It passed through the House Policy Committee unanimously. And so this indeed is something that I think we all know is something that is widely supported, the earned income tax credit, and especially the expansion. And so, as Sarah outlined, you know, from Cash Oregon, that a little bit, you know, a little bit of funds that EITC provides can make a difference, a huge difference in families' lives. And I want to just point out, these are families that are doing everything right. They're low income, they have kids, but they're working, they're filing their taxes. They are doing what we all hope they can do. They are building toward, you know, they're stabilizing their lives, building toward financial independence. And so, you know, and frankly, you know, if someone who's making $12.50 an hour, making $21,000 a year, they're at the poverty level if they have two kids. And I don't know exactly how they make it, frankly, but the EITC makes a huge difference in their lives. As you've heard in anecdotes previously, and as you've seen in research, as is up on the board, you've heard other people come up and testify. You know, in fact, by my count, this is the fourth time, I think, in the previous month that people have come up to talk about the earned income tax credit. But I just wanted to call out one that under the second bullet under EITC helps children succeed. That was one that before session, Senator Gelser pointed out to me It shows that the refundable EITC credit actually reduces child abuse. We have lower instances of abusive head trauma that show up in emergency rooms in states with the refundable tax credit, meaning that a credit that they can actually take home. And so that is, you know, something, you know, and many other studies that show the various benefits. So I guess I do want to also point out, as I said earlier, we don't want to exclude anyone who is doing right by the rules, who is working, filing their taxes. And so that means there's 70,000 children in this state that live in mixed status households. Those are households that where someone might have an ITIN number. You know, for whatever reason, they don't have a Social Security number and they're not eligible for the Oregon credit. We have an opportunity to remove that exclusion and make those children eligible for at least the state credit. They, and these are citizen children, you know, they haven't done anything. They should, if we think EITC is an important thing, we should include that as well. And so I want to conclude by mentioning three reasons that are not economic for including EITC. One, a small one, is that the update that Legislative Revenue Office recently did that showed that EITC was a little less expensive than we thought. Well, let's reinvest that money back into EITC. Also, EITC is eminently scalable. We have so many different options of whatever money that you have under that $70 million that you've been allotted to make it work and with whatever else. And then finally, just as a personal note, that I'm hoping that someday Oregon can catch up to Kansas, which has 17% of the match of the federal rate. But, you know, I would take catching up to Indiana, which is at 8%. Right now, we're below both those states. So I appreciate your time on this subject. And one thing, I know Senator Haas has said that no one in his time has spoken up against EITC. Well, there's a reason for it, because it's popular with both sides of the aisle and with advocates all over the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you for your testimony. Yeah. Next, we'll hear from Jessica Adamson, John Calhoun, Bob Estabrook. After that, Sam Barber, Philip Kennedy Wong.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Bob Estabrook for the Oregon School Employees Association. You probably all are used to seeing me up here saying, don't give away money. We don't like tax credits. We like having money for services, and that's very important. But I'm here today to highlight two tax credits that are themselves extremely important because of the dividends that I think they provide to us. At the top of the list is the earned income tax credit, which is very important not only to my members who, in a lot of cases, are only working part-time for a school district, do not have very high incomes, and themselves are eligible for the earned income tax credit, but also for the students that they work with and who they want to see succeed. As you've just heard, I won't reiterate all of that, but the dividends that are available through the investment that is the earned income tax credit are extremely valuable to our communities all across the state. The folks that I represent are not in the largest urban areas. In fact, typically our members are in smaller, more rural communities where those earned income tax credit dollars are actually even more invaluable and even more valuable and even more beneficial. I also want to highlight the political contribution tax credit, which I think obviously is very different than the EITC, but is important in some ways for the same reason in terms of the benefit available to lower income people to be able to more fully participate in the democratic process, in the decision-making process that affects our state. And we want to make sure that they continue to have every opportunity to do that rather than having that opportunity be foreclosed, which would only leave even more opportunity for folks who already have a strong voice to have an even stronger one, which I don't think is beneficial to the system. So we would very strongly urge the renewal, ideally the expansion of the earned income tax credit, as well as the renewal of the political contribution tax credit in Oregon. Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Haas, members of the committee, I want to echo, I'm John Calhoun representing Tax Fairness Oregon. I want to echo what Bob just said. we do want to encourage with political contribution reform, putting limits on the top that people at the bottom are encouraged to contribute. We do believe that you can reduce the income level for which the credit is available below the 100,000, 200,000 level today. We don't believe people at that end are motivated by the $50 and $100 to do political contributions, but we would like to protect it for those people of more modest incomes. If that frees up money, then we would encourage that additional money be directed to the EITC to the extent that that is possible.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. And we are here in strong support of the earned income tax credit portion of House Bill 2164. We really believe in our hearts that supporting the earned income tax credit is part of our commitment through our mission to stand in solidarity with the poor and vulnerable in our communities. We know that good health also includes good economic health. That stress comes to families who are poor and working at the margins, but these are families that are in our communities trying to do the best they can to raise children and to, in communities where costs continue to rise, the day-to-day expenses and the stress that they face in trying to meet those obligations makes it hard for families to function. And for us to be able to provide additional support to make work and the dignity of that work rewarded through the earned income tax credit is an outstanding way for us to support and to stand in solidarity with those doing the best they can. And that this these investments have a tremendous impact in local communities, particularly in the rural communities that Bob talked about, because these are dollars that aren't just going to get tucked away. These are dollars that are going to go into purchasing better food, that are going to be invested in purchasing items at the local store. So the economic benefit of this tax credit is greater than every dollar that you put in. There is additional economic activity that comes out. And so we encourage this committee to make as big of an investment in the earned income tax credit as possible. These dollars certainly come back to the local community and stimulate additional economic activity, and most importantly, help those that are poor and in need in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you all. Sam Barber and Philip Kennedy Wong. And is there anyone else in the audience who had hoped to testify on tax credits? Okay, thank you.
Go for it. Madam Chair and Chair Haas, members of the committee, for record, Philip Kennedy Wong. I want to, with Oregon Food Bank, I want to pick up where Jessica Adamson with Providence left off. So she mentioned food and low-income families, and I'm here to talk about two tax credits that are in the Dash 11s. And one is the earned income tax credit. And you'll see in my testimony, I did submit two pieces of, two pages, one addressing the earned income tax credit and the other addressing the food related part, which is crop donation tax credit, which all goes together in our food bank strategy to fight hunger, both at the root cause level, but also at the food level, where we can help to get more fresh foods into the families of families who are struggling to afford even like fresh produce at their local stores. So let me first start with the earned income tax credit. I'll be very brief because a lot of what's been said, I don't need to repeat, other than we do support any level of expansion to improve the earned income tax credit, especially if it's possible to include filers using the individual taxpayer ID numbers. I want to share with folks, if you look at my testimony, we still have a lot of folks that are struggling with food insecurity, even though we are in a record low unemployment period right now. But that just means the high cost of living have made it very, very difficult for families to meet their basic needs, which is why the earned income tax credit, i.e. a refund, you know, is very important to help, you know, those families. And on to the crop donation tax credit. I first want to begin by thanking essentially our original bill, which did not make it through this process, but I'm very happy to see that the standard renewal is part of the Dash 11s. But I would be remiss if I didn't thank the original co-sponsors of our other bill, which would have had a modest expansion. It was Senate Bill 241, and a big, thank you to Senators Thompson and Burdick, who were the co-chief sponsors of the Crop Donation Tax Credit the last cycle, Senator Hansel. And I also wanted to thank Senator Hass and Rep. Nathanson and Senator Bent for working with Oregon Food Bank the last couple of days to ensure that the renewal of the Standard Crop Donation Tax Credit was included in the Dash 11s, and we hope that it will stay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Hass, members of the committee, my name is Sam Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Rural Health Association. I first just want to say thank you for your inclusion of the volunteer EMS, volunteer rural EMS tax credit in the Dash 11 amendment. I am not sure that most Oregonians are aware that once they venture outside of the Willamette Valley, they are dependent in large part on volunteers should an emergency occur. The more rural the area, the more dependent upon volunteers the local emergency response agency is. Most volunteer EMS personnel must pay out of pocket for their initial training. This can cost around $2,000 and take up to two semesters to complete. In addition, they have continuing education requirements and other required expenses. They have to take time away from their families and loved ones in order to maintain an emergency response 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This credit helps defray some of those out-of-pocket costs and is a very small incentive for those who sacrifice so much for our health and safety. So we urge your extension of the credit, and thanks again.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you for your testimony. Thank you, everyone who has signed up for Act One, this part of the hearing. Now we will move to some technical adjustments. Mr. Allenack.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. So the main amendment here, there's a Dash 14 and a Dash 15. So the Dash, starting with the Dash 14, that replaces the Dash 1 from the other day. There is a document titled House Bill 2164-14 by section. So I can either go through that. It's basically a bullet point listing of the changes in the Dash 14. I can go through that or briefly just describe it.
Just briefly describe, please.
Okay. So for the most part, it's similar to the Dash 1 before, but the main piece is that it realigns the definitions for financials and insurers. It does clarify that interest income and service charges are part of the tax base for financials. And then it clarifies a number of items that are not commercial activity. And most of these were included in the prior version. I think I'm kind of, there might have been some refinement of the language relating to distilled liquor. Gratuities is added, and then some language changes around right-of-way fees. And then the next item down there is exclude certain payments related to residential construction. That one is in the Dash 14. It is not in the Dash 15. That's the only difference between the Dash 14 and Dash 15. And then for the most part, the other changes, there's a clarification of cost inputs. That's for the related to the 35% subtraction. Within the bill, it aligns this definition for excluded person for a threshold of $750,000. It's a reduction from $1 million, and that really aligns with the registration process. We had a conflict between where somebody could be an excluded person, but they'd have to register, so we lined those up. And then I think most of those were in there before. Yeah, the groceries, the hedging transactions, and the unrelated business income. And then section two, it's just a one-word change. The word receiving, this is in the definition of the tax, receiving the commercial activity to with the commercial activity. there is some confusion around referencing when we're trying to describe the incidence of the tax on the part of the business that is providing that is with the commercial activity versus the purchaser of the activity of the goods or service. Section 3, we clarified the language around the intercompany transfers to confirm that that was not part of the tax base. And then Section 4 was the preemption exemption, and that has been modified to include right-of-way fees due to other changes prior in the bill, that we have the right-of-way fee language in there now, so that's added there, as well as trying to clarify that the privilege tax, as long as it's not measured by commercial activity, it's exempt from the preemption. And then Section 5 and Section 6 are unchanged.
Thank you. Any questions before we begin the public? Yes, Senator Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Madam Co-Chair, Chris, on page 10, line 3, can you just explain was the change from 1 million to 750,000 to make that number consistent with the other 750,000 in the bill?
Correct. I'm trying to get to page 10.
Page 10, line 3.
Yes, here, this language right here on this page refers to the excluded people. These are the people that don't have to pay the tax. And that language, as you can see, was $1 million. But later on in the bill, it's not part of the amendment. The registration process was required for those that had $750,000 of commercial activity. So the way the bill read is you could, for example, have somebody with, say, $900,000 of commercial activity, and they would have been an excluded person, but they would have had to register. So that just didn't necessarily make sense. So it just lined those up. It does not change the incidence of the tax, which is the key thing.
Correct. And that's what I wanted you to say on the record. So okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Finley.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, the only difference between the dash 14 and the dash 15 is that certain payments related to residential construction section, the VV section in section 1?
Correct. If you're looking at the dash 14 on page 8, there's bold language lines 8 to 18 that was removed. And then that's how you get to the dash 15.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay.
But in the dash 14, this language was refined from the earlier version.
Anything else? Let's call our first panel. Jonathan Sandow, Tammy Denny, Elizabeth Remling.
Chair Nathanson, Chair Haas, members of the committee, John Sando with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Just for a quick reference, Oregon Farm Bureau is Oregon's largest agricultural organization. We're one of the most diverse and comprehensive coalitions out there for Oregonians, farmers, and ranchers. I just want to start off, before I forget, to thank Chris, especially, and the LRO staff for all the work that they have done around this whole process and everything that we've gone through. So. We also have written comments on the record, and so I'll be brief in my verbal comments, but you guys can reference those for a little bit more in depth. So we're here today really to support the kind of the dash 8 amendments that are posted for 2164. We were encouraged with the dash 1s that came out. There was kind of a partial list of agricultural commodities that were tied with the grocery things. And the dash 14s, those were removed. And we really do encourage the dash 8 language to be part of the larger bill. And we bring this forward, and we're talking about this because we do think that this language is technical within the nature of it, because it does mitigate the economic division that the new tax law creates kind of in our sector. And the language that really that's in the dash 8s is really trying to get at that farm gate level of sales, which is considered a taxable activity when sold in state, and can lead to really those neighboring farms and even crops of the same field being subject to different tax rates. and when the farmers are take that product to a wholesaler. You know, there's a lot of determination that, oh, is it in-state, out-of-state, that is left up to the wholesaler themselves and not necessarily to the farmer. And so that really cuts back on how much they can plan for their tax liability. You know, how high a degree of certainty does that wholesaler have on which part of their crop is going in or out of state? And so there's a lot of division there, especially when it comes to, you know, commingling efforts such as wheat and other crops of that nature. And so, you know, another one that we want to look at is, like, this legislative body is considering a large investment in our farm and school program, which is a great program. And it's our understanding, because farmers are not considered wholesalers underneath the new tax law, is that that participation is, because it's an in-state sale, would be a taxable activity and count towards that total receipts. And that, you know, that could lead to the discouraging participation of that meaningful program. And then finally, we really have a kind of a food safety requirement issue that we want to highlight, where products are sold off the farm to often meet these food safety requirements. And I want to say the biggest example that we have is our kind of our raw fluid milk, where you cannot transport that across state lines until it becomes pasteurized. And so our dairy farmers don't even have the option to, you know, sell that out of state to avoid the tax. And so that, you know, I think that, you know, we have a lot of other FSMA, the Food Safety Modernization Act, does a lot of the requirement around fresh produce in a similar thing. So, again, we just wanted to bring this issue up, you know, encourage the Dash 8 language to be incorporated in a larger context, because, I mean, our farmers and ranchers out there, they operate on very low margins in dynamic years based on weather, pests, disease, costs can be much higher than anticipated, much higher than in years past, and you can easily hit that, you know, that threshold of becoming subject to the tax with your activity. You know, and we bring it forward again because we believe in the support of local cultivation and the local markets for Oregon agricultural products. So thank you.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Haas, members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Nurseries, supporting the Dash 8 amendments, supporting everything that Jonathan Sandow said for the Farm Bureau. The nursery industry is Oregon's either first or second largest agricultural industry, depending on the year. We're in a fight with cattle all the time, but it represents about $1 billion of revenue to the state of Oregon. This tax, we have polled some of our members. It results in an effective increased tax rate on personal income tax of about 15% on average, because most of our members are sole proprietors, small businesses. They're not taking a corporate profit. They're not paying a corporate income tax or paying a personal income tax. But this, I have an example here of a $10 million in-state sales. After taking out the cost of goods sold deduction, they're paying about a $60,000 tax on their sales in Oregon, according to this math. That's for a single family income, that's a pretty large chunk of their income that they're paying back in taxes on GRT. We have other members who have expressed a concern about the increased costs of carbon. The carbon bill is going to cost a ton of money for them in natural gas, transportation costs. We have, we're hitting the peak of our increases on minimum wage. We're looking at a paid family leave payroll tax in a different committee as we speak. My members aren't sure how they're going to grow in this state. We already have a workforce shortage that prevents nursery members from growing at their normal average economic growth. They could grow 20%. Maybe they're limiting their growth to 2% because they can't find workers. They're not going to be able to grow at all if we keep adding costs to their bottom line. So I know that all of you know this and you have all thought about this, and it's a policy choice that you've made. But I do believe that, and the nurseries believe that, the agricultural industry is in some ways unique in the way that it is treated and it does business in the state of Oregon. And one final note, there is a section in the bill that treats property leasing as a sale. In agriculture, farmers lease property to each other all the time. It is not the same thing as being a landlord. It is just part of the sharecropping and other ways that you know, will have a son and a father running farms across the street from each other, and they will lease property to each other. They're going to get taxed on that under this bill. I don't think the legislature ever intended to do that because they're not using the leasing of that property as their main income. But it's a huge concern for my members. So I just wanted to point those things out, and we encourage you to either take a look at the Dash 8s or hopefully we can have a conversation about this stuff. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? And Tammy, fine. John Calhoun and Diana Stressmeyer.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is John Calhoun. I'm representing Tax Fairness Oregon. Only a couple of points on the subcontractor provision. We like the Dash 15, but if Dash 14 stays in, we think that's an improvement over Dash 1, but would ask you to consider if that state provision stayed in, putting a restriction on the size of the house or the price of the house. We don't need to subsidize millionaire houses. Second point is the tip provision. It makes sense that it's not part of the business if I leave a tip for someone that then is processed through the business. However, there are other businesses like hairdressers and maid services and so on where the same activity happens, and it's no different than being in a restaurant. And it doesn't make sense to provide it to one and not the other. A provision that you may want to consider that isn't in here relates to the referral of HB 3427, the Success for Schools Act. The current referral by the Oregon Manufacturers and Commerce removes the Section 80, the separability clause, which, if they are successful in their referral, and the citizens vote this down, we would be stuck with no revenue, but a provision to cut personal income taxes by $500 million and provide $2 billion of funds to schools that no longer exist. It may be worth considering a provision in this bill that deals with that severability so that even if their measure is successful for them and the school HB 3427 is rejected, that you wouldn't end up with only the tax revenue piece cut out. We don't know what the solution is, but that would be a big problem.
Good afternoon, Senator Haas, Representative Nathanson. Thank you very much for having us this afternoon. My name is Diana Strassmeyer. I am the Director of Architecture and Engineering Services for Aldrich CPAs and Advisors. And I am here representing the American Council of Engineering Companies. That organization, the Oregon chapter, has approximately 120 member firms in the state of Oregon, and that includes about 3,700 employees in the state of Oregon. We are concerned about the amendment, the language in 14, which hopefully is now gone. But the main concern is that now we have this term of agent that's being used, that if we're going to follow the Ohio commercial activity tax methodology, then we need to be more concise about what agency would include. For instance, in the Ohio commercial activities tax, there's a discussion about different types of contract and whether you're acting as an agent in a cost plus reimbursement contract versus a fixed price contract. We're concerned that, especially in the area of engineering, there is not the opportunity to mark up subcontractor costs, and so those costs are really a pass-through to the subcontracting entity.
a major issue becomes when we have joint ventures and other companies that are interested in working in Oregon and having subcontracting work here in Oregon. There is no markup, so a joint venture that is its own taxable entity would end up having to pay tax where it nets, its net income is zero, because it has to pay the subcontractors 100% of what it earns. So we would like to have clarification in the language that an agency relationship under a cost reimbursement contract is assumed. And certainly we'd be up for having a conversation more in depth about that and the implication of the current bill as it stands. And I think that that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you for being with us. Was there anyone else wishing to testify on this portion? Committee, any other discussion or questions for LRO? And Representative Findley, at the beginning of the meeting, when you were helping me stall, maybe, did you have an additional question or comment?
I'll defer to Representative Smith for now, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I apologize that I had to miss the first part of the hearing. Can you share with me what our potential plans are as it relates to the political tax credit? Do we have an idea on how that's going to play through?
Well, there is an amendment to include the political tax credit. We've heard testimony today. It's certainly under consideration. Senator Haas.
Thank you.
Yes.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back and talk a little bit about the House Bill 2164, the -3, which is a food processing equipment. We've had a lot of discussion offline about whether the -3 is the proper way to the vehicle for that, or it's House Bill 2900, mm-hmm. which is the proper carrier. And I just wanted to sort it out, so as time's run close, and if we had my way, we'd be done by noon tomorrow. I don't think that'll happen. So I guess timing-wise, I don't want to lose this. This is a pretty critical program in my district, and I want to make sure the right vehicle. I think we have a pretty good agreement, as Mr. Smith said in his testimony. We talked about being able to allow the city to throttle it down. Representing Marsh and I met with folks, and I thought we had a pretty good agreement. So wherever that is, whatever process that moves forward with, I'd like to see that it happens.
Senator Haas.
Thank you. I very much appreciate the work that you, Representative Marsh, have done on that bill. It will definitely be in this. I'm assuming it will get the necessary votes, and it will likely be the product that you guys have both agreed to. And so that's kind of what's still in the air, but one way or another, it will be.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you much.
Anything else for this afternoon?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So the EITC, and what are our choices going to be when that motion is or amendment is proposed? Do we know yet? Is it if it's going to be an extension, that would be interesting. If it's going to be increased, that would be interesting. When will that decision be before us?
By Friday. That's it. And also, we're looking to see how LRO will be pricing out everything that we're considering, because we have a budget to fit within. So how much can we fit, squeeze into that budget, Senator Haas?
Yes, I think that's exactly right, that LRO needs to calculate these costs when we get the final project. And it was my hope that if there is some leftover change, that we will be able to extend it and increase it, even by a small amount. But, Dr. Thoughts?
Thank you, Co-Chair. I guess the question to Chris would be the federal EITC has a cost of living element to it, which I think is 3%, and we need some verification on that to understand what that underlying increase is at the federal level. so that when we are taking into account the choice that we'll have on the EITC, which I've supported through the 12 years I've been here, we can look at it in the light of that which is at the federal level also. So that would be of interest to me, to see if my understanding that the federal credit has increased by 3% since the last time, since 2 years ago or whenever. Just some explanation on that would be helpful.
Sure. It does increase with inflation. I can confirm the 3%. I don't know the exact amount, but it does adjust. And that those kinds of adjustments are, I guess, just for the committee, are embedded in all of the forecasts. We have, those are implicitly included in all of the forecasts that we have and would be included in the estimates of the change. But if you're interested, we can work to separate that piece out, or do you just want a confirmation of the 3%?
Confirmation.
Okay.
Anything else from Marsh, Boquist? No other questions, no other discussion or comments. Our business is done for today. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2164. That's all. We're adjourned.